Greetings, dear listeners, and welcome to another edition of Sci-Frights, the film discussion podcast at the Interzone where horror meets science fiction. I am, of course, Liam Dunn, and with me, as always, is Lindsay Hellam.
Hello.
Today we've got something a little more special, something that we're trying out. This is something that we call Sci-Frights Bites. And Lindsay, do you want to tell us what that is?
So basically it is a bite-sized episode of Sci-Frights where we look at a more recent release and we don't go as long as our usual episodes, which are always going on for like 2 hours.
Or God willing, we don't.
Yeah, we do often get carried away once we get into something. But the idea is that we're trying to make this as short as possible and just give you a quick roundup of our thoughts on something that's out in the cinemas right now. So what film did we look at? What did we just watch?
We have just seen 28 Years Later, the much long-awaited sequel to 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later, with returning director Danny Boyle and returning writer Alex Garland.
So, I mean, we can start off, I think, by just going back to those first two films, because this new film, yeah, is definitely calling back to those first two films, but it's also doing something quite different. So just thinking back, I mean, I think now, all these years later, 28 Days Later comes out in 2002. Now I think it's been seen as a bit of a modern classic, a bit of a horror classic, modern horror classic. So, I mean, can you go back to when you first saw 28 Days Later? Did you go see it at the cinema?
I must have. I don't have a clear recollection of seeing it in the cinema, but I must have seen it. I mean, it was Danny Boyle doing a horror film. I don't think he'd done a horror film up until that point. And I remember all the marketing for it, though, was about because they were shooting on digital and there was the now iconic shot and scene of Cillian Murphy wandering through the empty streets of London. I do remember a lot of buzz around the film at the time. And I do remember going to see it at some point and just being absolutely gobsmacked by it. What about you?
Yeah, I remember seeing it in the cinema. I remember in particular that scene where it's like they're in a tunnel and they're all running and they're trying to get the car fixed.
Yeah.
Oh, my God, yeah. It was, I definitely loved the film. I ended up at one point when I was doing my PhD, it was going to be a film that I was going to look at in my section on zombies, which we need to just quickly, you know, let in a bit talk about the whole is it a zombie film or not. But I didn't end up using it in the PhD. So it was something that for a while there, though, I was really investigating and getting into. But the most recent screening that I've seen the film at was on the big screen again. When was it? There was a film screening for Distorted Frame, which is the film club, yeah, that you organize.
It was the first screening that we ever did, actually, and it was we held out to get the screening rights to do 28 Days Later because it was a bit of a mission because the sequel was still due to come out. This was July last year, and the sequel was, you know, touted and was set to come out, and the rights had reverted back to Danny Boyle's production company, DNA Films, and we luckily were able to get the rights to screen it. And that was the first time I'd even seen it in a really long time. And it was amazing to see up on the big screen. And you forget in 2002, the digital, I mean, they were used sort of consumer digital cameras, didn't they? Or at least the first really big professional one, but they were tiny. And I remember it looking so different at the time and so revolutionary and so new. And now you look back on it from, and it's like, it's so grainy and it's so, it does look like a bit of a relic now. But that's also part of why it looks so great as well. I think it still really worked because it's that street level, visceral nature of the film that you wouldn't. A film would look too clean. A camera from a big Hollywood studio would look too polished. You needed that found footage style to it.
Yeah, because it didn't look like any other films that were being made. Certainly, films that were being made on that level by a well-known director. But it was looking like weird footage that we were seeing on TV, say on the news, and certainly the fact that this comes out in 2002, not long after 9/11. In fact, 9/11 happened while they were shooting. And so during 9/11 and all of that, we were seeing people's grainy, handheld, shot-on-the-fly footage that people just happened to be filming while these huge events were happening. And I think from that point on, what you were seeing on the news was what people were filming themselves, and news companies were obviously picking that footage up because they weren't there, they with their professional news cameras when it was happening. So the film really inadvertently, and, you know, it didn't know that it was going to be, you know, linked to this event, because it was, I think, the first horror film that came out after 9/11 that seemed to be quite directly commenting on it, even though, it wasn't made with that intention at all. And the fact that they were filming when it happened, I believe that they were filming in a tower block in London. And of course, at that time, you know, people just didn't know when 9/11 was happening, whether it was just going to be in America, whether there were going to be more attacks. And you would think London would be one of the next places to be attacked. So it definitely was just unbeknownst to, as they were filming, it was going to be, I think, so linked with that time. And a lot of that is because of the decision to shoot digital, which now looks very, very much early digital. And that's very, a lot of what your film club is all about is, it is interesting to go to the screenings and to see these early digital films and what digital has become since then. And obviously the new film is shot on iPhone. I think it's iPhone 15 Pro. So that these films over the years have really engaged with the changing digital technology. But I think we also need to talk about one of the things that happened when you were advertising your screening of 28 Days Later is that you had the audacity to refer to this as a zombie film, and there were some quite heated reactions of
people were getting a bit spicy online about it. So I think there's a dividing line, I think, from in the early 2000s when these news, for want of a better word, zombie films were coming out, because the remake of Dawn of the Dead was like 2 years after 28 Days Later, and they had the fast zombies, and everyone was saying that zombies aren't fast, they're slow and blah, blah, blah. But I think, like, everyone's entitled to their opinion, but, I mean, the filmmakers themselves said that they were zombies, and I think they even dropped the Z word in the new one as well. So, I mean, if the filmmakers say they're zombies, then they're zombies as far as I'm concerned. But everyone is entitled to their opinion on that, I suppose. But I think it's just, it's all a matter of taste, I think.
Indeed. I guess in some way, I definitely think the filmmakers were engaging with the zombie narrative as it had been up to that point. Certainly there were, I think, there's references to the Romero zombie films, because with the Romero zombie films, those were the first ones where the zombie was linked to the coming apocalypse and the breakdown of society and breakdown of civilization. Whereas before that, zombies had been linked to Haitian voodoo. So ever since the Romero zombie films, it was linked to the apocalypse, that the zombies were this harbinger. So you have, and they were very much about how people react to each other. So the zombies in the Romero films were they were the threat, but really the issue was how people, like, either decided to help each other or they didn't. In Night of the Living Dead, it's just people in a house and they still can't get along, even though there's these things, which in Night of the Living Dead, they never refer to them as zombies, they refer to them as ghouls.
Yeah.
But I think definitely 28 Days Later has that aspect of it, of what Romero always said, which is, in my films, the villains are always the living.
Yeah.
So there is the fact that the infected, they're not dead. So that's the thing that's different to, like, the Romero zombie type. and they're infected with this rage virus. Also, it just not only are they fast moving, but they change really quickly. So there isn't the slow, gradual change that you get in zombie films where someone's bitten and they try and hide it and then they suddenly gradually change. The infection is almost like they're bitten and then immediately they change and they start vomiting blood and they get the crazy red eyes and so on. So it's definitely different to the zombie in that they're not dead and it's an infection and they move fast and the whole thing is so fast. And I mean, that was another thing about the first film is that it was so visceral. And again, I think the immediacy of the digital video played into that, that it's just such this visceral kind of almost extreme physical reactions, and it is very still very frightening, I think, the first film.
Well, I think the fact that it was 2002 and it was, you know, the new millennium, I think that says something to the way that they reinvented this or did a spin on it. Yeah, it's a rage virus and everything's quick and everything's intense and visceral. That feels like a very 2000s thing, doesn't it? Like kind of, you know, you've got like Nu Metal and New French Extremity and the X Games and all this like extreme stuff happening.
And video games. Resident Evil.
Yeah. And also, yeah, and it's all the news cycle and, you know, it is prefiguring. I mean, I think YouTube was around, but like it was really prefiguring the kind of YouTube era. So yeah, I think it's something very 2000s about the way that they did these zombies, infected, whatever you want to call them.
Mm. And then also, I mean, another link back to the zombie films, especially the Romero films, is that in 28 Days Later, you also had so it starts off in London, and the main protagonist, who was supposed to be coming back in the new films at some point, supposedly, we'll see. He wakes up and he's been in hospital, and then he discovers, you know, what's happened. And within 28 days, the virus has run rampant and London has pretty much just been shut down. He finds the character played by Naomi Harris, takes up with her, and then they end up meeting with Brendan Gleeson and his daughter. And so they're meeting some other people that they bond with, but then once they go out into the countryside and then they meet him with these army characters, these military kind of military troop run by Christopher Eccleston, they are definitely the main villains.
Yeah.
Not only are they chaining up the infected and, yeah, there's some awful things happening with what they're doing to the infected. But then the whole thing is that they have designs on the two young women as well. It's definitely, I think, playing on the idea that the villains are the living, and that the main thing is that even as civilization, it doesn't take much for civilization to completely collapse and for people to just descend into savagery. Those military men were just as savage as the infected, even more insidiously so.
Well, and they've got no excuse, do they? Because they've still got their wits about them. They've still got, intellect and faculties, and yet this is what they're doing.
Mm. And, it's interesting, you've got these army characters, and one of the things that struck me as I was watching 28 Days Later, July last year, was that earlier in the year we'd watch Alex Garland's Civil War. And I really felt like that there was some connections with Civil War, and that in Civil War they're traveling around and they're meeting different people. And definitely, I mean, also Alex Garland's most recent film, Warfare. And so he seems very interested in the military. And it definitely feels like it's a thing about Danny Boyle's work or Danny Boyle's filmography is that he does have this really dynamic, kinetic style to his films, but he often will work with quite strong writers, like writer voices. I think that, the work that he's done with Alex Garland, but also his last film before this was Yesterday, which was written by Richard Curtis. We haven't seen it. But from what I hear, it's very much a Richard Curtis film. He did Jobs, which was written by Aaron Sorkin. So it almost seems like in terms of a authorial voice that often Danny Boyle will just be in service to the writer. So it definitely feels like felt like that the watching it 28 days later the last time was that it felt I could see and hear Alex Garland's voice coming through. I think
Boyle works very collaboratively with the screenwriters, because I do think the reason why I can't remember who was working with who was there was an interesting writer on board. They were going to do the Bond, like what became Skyfall, and they left the project because they were being too boxed in by the producers and things like that. So I think, yeah. But he does work with a very varied group of writers. I think him and Garland have an interesting dynamic.
Because they also did Sunshine as well.
Yeah.
And in that, it's a science fiction, but it's about, you know, a coming apocalypse and a community and how we're going to deal with...
And it's another travel movie where they have to go from point A to point B to point C and meet people on the way.
But one of the other things that about watching 28 Days Later again is we were watching it here in London, and we've been living in London for over a decade. It hits different recognizing so much, because definitely the first film and the second film as well feel very rooted in London, and now we can recognize it. And the film, you know, has those iconic scenes of they shut the, which bridge was it?
So Westminster Bridge.
Westminster Bridge, they shut it all down. But yeah, they did a lot of it. They were filming around Canary Wharf. And so it is very recognizable now. But yeah, moving on to 28 Weeks Later, which we just watched a couple of nights ago again. So I'd only seen that once. And I remember it being quite strong and impactful and visceral like the first film. But I realized as I was watching it, I could not remember a thing about it.
Yeah. Yeah, I think I remember thinking it was, not the best sequel, but still pretty good. I think this is there was a case to be made for even more films after this. I guess it didn't do – I mean, it was 6 years after – or 4 years after the – original, so it felt a bit late. It seems like maybe perhaps Boyle was going to make it at some point, and then it just got caught up in development hell, and then it got passed over to a new director, to Juan Carlos Fresnadillo. So I think it suffers a bit from that. But I think it's okay. I think watching it again, I think being in that world again is kind of is always fun. You can tell the budget's a bit less because they're shooting it in Canary Wharf and the Docklands and stuff, which at the time I think was pretty much empty because it was during the week, the weekends, because it's where people went to work. It's a lot different there now. There's a big cast of actors who would go on to be massive stars.
It's stacked.
It's really stacked.
And I totally forgot that we've got Robert Carlyle, who I did remember, but I did not remember Jeremy Renner, Harold Perrineau, Rose Byrne, Idris Elba, or Imogen Poots, all being in the film. But yeah, that's the thing, is that the film, this thing is the, what I obviously did kind of remember was that the opening scene of the second one is incredible.
Really
and it's the whole thing, it's Robert Carlyle and his wife, played by Catherine McCormick, in this, obviously, in this place that they're holed up with other people. The infection has started. They get set upon by all these infected. And then there's this moment where Catherine McCormick tries to save this little child that had come to the house, and the infected had come into the room, and Robert Carlyle runs away. Rather than helping his wife and this child, he runs away. And then it's the whole thing of, as it goes on, it's she realizing, oh, she survived. And then it's this whole thing of, and he's got his children who are out of the country who've now come back. And he's essentially lying to them, saying, oh, yeah, there was nothing I could do. They had killed her and I had to run away. And that's the thing, is that that's a really great setup. And then once he's reunited with his wife, and then it turns out that she's immune some way. But then when they kiss, he gets infected and he kills her. And then he's just suddenly one in the he's infected. And so it was all these really interesting moral questions that, you know, were being raised, and how is he going to deal with this and possibly being confronted with what he did? And then it just becomes like, oh, and now the American military here and they go off with the kids. It was just like, yeah. I was a bit disappointed as I was watching again, because I'd obviously remembered the early scenes and been like, oh, yeah, amazing, visceral, impactful. And then as it goes on, it just kind of lost a bit of steam for me.
Yeah, I agree.
So, all right, but let's go to 28 years later. Do you want to give a bit of a synopsis? Starting off with non-spoilery stuff, and then we will signal when we go to spoilers.
So it kind of starts, there's like a cold open, which is set at the around 2002, the time of the original film, where we kind of see a bit of stuff happen with, there's this young boy hiding out, or there's his family with kids, and I think it's some kind of community. And then the infected arrive, and this little boy runs out, finds his father, who's a priest, and there's all these people get attacked and everything. And I think, and then I won't say too much, but then it like jumps forward to 28 years later. It gives us a little spiel about, to catch us up on what has happened. I don't think I'm spoiling too much to say the UK is now a complete quarantine zone, because in 28 weeks later, there's a suggestion that the virus makes it to the mainland, so they kind of scrub,
or to Europe.
To Europe, sorry. And then they kind of say, yeah, but that was okay. We worked that out, but the UK, we can't do anything about it. It's completely blocked off now. So everyone, the rest of the world's moved on. They've lived their 28 years normally, but the UK is this post-apocalyptic wasteland. And we're introduced to this community that lives on this island that's connected to the mainland of UK through a causeway, which is obviously underwater during high tide. So they've been able to shut themselves off from the rest of everything, keep the infected away. They've kind of regressed to sort of this farm life, where everyone in the village has a job, and they train the kids to have, you know, everyone's either a farmer or a baker or this, that and the other. They all contribute to the society. But they do go out to the mainland to raid for supplies and things like that. And so that's where we find a young boy, Spike, who's the son of Aaron Taylor-Johnson and Jodie Comer. And Aaron Taylor-Johnson's going to take Spike out on his first hunt with a bow and arrow to go to the mainland, and he's going to train him in how to survive out there because he's becoming a man. All the while, his mum is bedridden with a mysterious illness because the village has no doctor, so we don't know what's wrong with her. And so Spike's taken out on a mission with his father, and then things go awry. We'll leave it there. And when they're out on the mainland, a lot of things are revealed to Spike, which then come back later in the film.
Mm. So I guess we can just start off with general thoughts. So I loved it.
Mm-hmm.
On my letterbox, I've given it 4.5 stars.
Okay.
Part of me wonders whether I might go back down to 4, but I don't know. I've come out of it really, really feeling very positive about it. And I'm looking and seeing online, and it's quite divisive. I know there's a lot of people who really have reacted against the film because it isn't exactly like those first two films. It's going off into some really different areas. Tonally, I think it's quite different as well. I mean, the fact that you've got a child protagonist was quite surprising, because it ends up becoming a coming of age story, really, which is nothing like what you get in the first two films. So for me, I loved that it actually expanded the scope of the story, and really takes it to a mythic level. And almost a spiritual level as well. Mm. I think that it has definitely leaned into its Britishness, which I want us to talk about, to the point where, to me, it almost seems like there's what I could even almost call folk horror aspects to the film as well. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I had to think about it for a while after seeing it, and the next day. Because I really liked it, and then I was like, there's so many things happening, and there's so many little details, and it almost feels like they're coming up against each other. I mean, it really feels like a film of three parts, like they film these distinct three parts. It's almost like they're different episodes, but Spike kind of keeps them all together because he's the main character. The whole coming of age story was a bit of a surprise. And I think even I was reading an article that the marketing doesn't mention that. And I think a lot of people are either pleasantly surprised or unpleasantly surprised by that aspect to it, because they were hoping for this big visceral tour de force thing, and it's a lot more meditative than that. I mean, it's got its action, it's got some scary moments, but yeah, it really actually is more interested in expanding the, you talk about folk horror, it's expanding the folklore of this world, because we're now almost three decades of this thing happening. So you've got new generations of people being born where it's like they're separate from any idea of what the world was like before then. They've got no link to the past. They only know this world. And the thing with Spike is that the only world he's known is this island, and now he gets to go and explore this new world, which he has no frame of reference for. And I think what this shows is that all these years later, Boyle and Garland have, you know, they've gone and made more films, and Garland's become, because he started out as a novelist, and through his collaborations with Boyle, he's become this screenwriter and a director. And they're older, they're a little bit wiser, they've deepened their talents and their concerns, and have become, you know, they've become fathers, and they've, you know, so I think they're not going to be telling the same stories that they were told in 2002. They're going to deepen this. And so I think it has this push and pull between the past and the present and the future, which I think is something that they're definitely trying to explore with this film and probably the ones that come after if those happen. Mm-hmm.
But yeah, let's just quickly talk about the visual style. So they're using the iPhone 15 Pro Max. So it's still very much digital, but it's this new, somewhat newish form of digital. So it's interesting that, yeah, that the first film had these consumer grade cameras, and yeah, seeing it again, it looks very grainy. I've even heard in interviews Danny Boyle saying, I can't believe that they let us get away with how bad it looks. You know, that there are points where figures and people on screen almost look like weird blobs. It's kind of very low def standard.
Well, they do that in the new one too. I mean, I think there's scenes in the village and stuff where it's got this really shallow depth of field, which it might be the lenses that they use. It reminded me a bit of another zombie film that the one that Zack Snyder made, where he shot using these, is it Army of the Dead or whatever?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
But he used this really shallow depth of field. And I think even the cold open, because it's set in 2002, I think they go back. I don't know if they actually go, but it seems like they went back and used the cameras for that to give you that. And I think they wanted a bit of that carry through to make, because this world is still stuck in 2002, right? So they want to evoke that era. So they do revisit some of that visual style a little bit, but then they add these new things. Like they've obviously, I've seen the behind the scenes photos where they've got these iPhones all linked up in this rig, and you're like, what are they doing there? And then when you watch it, they do this like bullet time thing. This really, whenever a zombie gets like pinned, they do this quick zoom around as the arrow goes in or whatever. And it's wild. And it's almost like they're actually, even though they've become these more experienced filmmakers and they're telling these deeper stories, they still want to like bring this kinetic style, but in a new way.
They're still trying out things with this new technology.
Yeah, exactly.
And the fact that the phones are so, I mean, the consumer grade cameras before were small. I mean, this is just a small little phone. Yeah. I mean, they do, and they can rig it up in all these different ways. It gets so close sometimes as well. In a way that you couldn't even with just a kind of a digital camera. But yeah, I mean, moving on, I think one of the things that I really loved about the film, as I said, was this taking it to this mythic level, almost this folk horror thing that was going on. And I think, yeah, it's definitely leaning into this Britishness, the fact that Britain has become completely shut off from the rest of the world. And because it hasn't been able to progress. So there is a one point where they're Spike meets someone from Sweden, and you can, and he kind of he has a phone, and you can see that obviously outside of Britain, it has progressed to what we have today in terms of technology. But Britain is because they've not had that technology, they don't have that technology anymore. They're almost at this subsistence level now, and there's all these intercutting also of footage of soldiers and medieval, like there's shots I think of Laurence Olivier, of like it's like Henry V. So there's all these images from wartime, and also from medieval, the fact that they use bow and arrows, like the whole thing is that when Spike goes out with his dad Jamie for this almost rite of passage, he has a bow and arrow, and it's all about getting this headshot. A lot of it also seemed very post-World War II as well. There's all these signs throughout where they're living in the community, like only use what you can or what you need. You know, there's the shower, and it's like, only use as much as you need to. And so it's also harking back to this time of like rationing, but it also, I think, plays on almost maybe the nostalgia that there is. I mean, living here for, they love World War II here. Like that was like the greatest time. And you know, the time when Britain was, you know, Britain and British people were at their greatest. And it is almost like that, this looking back in this nostalgia, which, I mean, certainly in America, you've got this whole thing. It's very regressive of Make America Great Again. And I think here in Britain, you get people like Nigel Farage who are, you know, trying to take us back to that time as well. So there's this interesting aspect of it that, you know, that of this nostalgia, this imagery, like there's the use of the Boots poem by Rudyard Kipling that was used in the trailer. And apparently Danny Boyle saw the trailer and then went, oh, we're going to put this in the film. And it's actually, it's a poem called Boots by Rudyard Kipling. And it was written in 1903. It's a British soldier marching in South Africa during the Boer War. And it's a recording from 1915. So there's all this post-World War II, but just looking back to, I guess, these great British accomplishments. It makes me also think of Danny Boyle doing T2, the Trainspotting sequel, and that was so much about nostalgia and how you can't go back again. So I think there's this interesting aspect of, like, in some ways they've managed to get back to, like, the land, and they have created this quite lovely community there where they are all looking after each other. But yet there's this interesting little darkness that there's one bit where there's all these shots of the Queen when she was young. And I believe that Danny Boyle actually refused a knighthood. So he's not one for the for the royal family. He's actually apparently like quite a staunch Republican in terms of wanting a republic. There's this. I don't know how you see this play of this Britishness, because one of the first shots in the, as it moves to 28 years later, is all these British flags are everywhere. So I don't know what your thoughts were, like, leaning into the Britishness.
Well, I mean, it's also like, because if you know, it's also a post Brexit film, because, and it's almost like that nostalgia for the time of like rationing and stuff is almost like, in the extreme, what kind of a cut-off Britain would be like, I think, because, we even, when Brexit was happening, there was a whole thing about, like, you know, because how we're going to get goods and services and things like that from Europe, and there was a whole thing with the border with Ireland and how that was going to cause a whole thing. And there was a time where, and I don't know if it was Brexit-related, but with, you know, cost of living and stuff, there was time when, you know, the shelves were a bit empty and things like that. So so it's definitely this thing of like fear of outsiders and wanting to circle the wagons and try and be self-sustaining and all these sorts of things. And because there's the doctor character in the film, which they're just like, stay away from this guy, he's insane. And it's all about, well, it's never quite that way, isn't it? And even I think the view of the infected is different from when you look at like the guy from Sweden, like there's like this group of people in a patrol boat who end up on the in the UK who are from Europe. There's the guy from Sweden who just views the infected as just things to be killed immediately. But you kind of over the course of the film, you realize that the people who still live there have a different relationship to them than those on the outside. I was saying in an interview that I read that they really want to comment on nostalgia and the way sort of you they're using the UK as an example, but the way nations think of themselves and how that can kind of come up against reality.
Yeah, because I was thinking at one point where after, well, there is a scene where all the community come together and they're, you know, they're rejoicing and celebrating. And I remember thinking, oh, yeah, this is like a reform party wet dream, what's happening here. And one of the things that's also, I think, very prevalent in this community is that gender roles have reverted back because it's very traditional. Like the men are the ones who have, like there's one shot where it was in the school and it said roles in our community and it was like farmer, baker, so on. And I noticed at one point it said seamster and it was a picture of a man at a sewing machine. Mm. And I was thinking, well, seamstress is like the most obvious, one of the most obvious like women's roles. Mm. But the only time you saw the women was when they were preparing for this celebration. Mm. They were all there setting the whole thing up, putting all the food out. And they all had these aprons on that looked very 1940s. Mm. And so I'm thinking that men were the only ones who had the roles in the society, and that women were, I'm assuming, were wives and mothers, and that's what their role was. So it was very regressive in that sense. Although there is this one older woman that you see who's sort of patrolling the gates of the community, but on the whole, it was very much the whole thing of the father taking the son out.
Yeah.
And this whole thing of that, it was obviously the men who, I'm assuming, go out to the mainland and that the women have to stay behind. Mm. So there was definitely this regressive aspect to the community. And I think it's also, there's Brexit, also, post-COVID, thing about infections and how things are so, the fact that it is so fast moving and how it felt like things changed so quickly and how you just have to adjust to the new normal and how quickly you adjust to the new normal. But then also, you know, as it goes along, you start to try and test the boundaries of what you can do now. So their whole thing of going on to the mainland and then coming back and, that they're just seeing how far they can get beyond their community. And also, post-austerity, you know, the way they're living is, having to do with very little. And also this idea of a rage virus. We live in these very angry, rage-filled
times.
Yes.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah, and also a lot of division, that you have this very clear division between the people and the infected. The infected are shunned. They're dehumanized. But then also how someone like Dr. Kelson is almost banished or separated from the rest of them. The man of science, the whole thing of like there's no doctors there.
Yeah, true.
So it's just interesting the little kind of thematic undercurrents that I think are there in through the way this community has been set up, which I think is, very much about today. So I think, shall we move into spoiler territory now?
Absolutely.
All right. So if you haven't seen the film, I definitely recommend going out to see it at the cinema. Please do go and see it at the cinema. We need people to go see things at the cinema. Listen to the rest of it from this point. For those of you who have seen the film, all right, let's go into it. So you mentioned before about the film being structured in three parts. Mm. I mean, what are those three parts for you that you...
Well, I guess barring the cold open, which is like, which shows us something that's going to come back late, like sort of that feeds into the ending. You basically have the villagers on the island. You've got Jamie Spike and, what's Jodie Comer's character's name?
Isla.
And you've got and you see their dynamic and the villagers on the island and how that all works, and you get the first glimpses of this coming of age story where Jamie's going to take Spike out for his first hunt, and they go to the mainland and they find these bloated, infected crawling around, easy pickings for his first kill to get him blooded. And you see Spike's nervousness, and you know, he hasn't done this before, but his dad's very encouraging. And so you get this kind of, you know, that traditional, he's becoming a man because he's going out and he's making his first kill and he's doing his first sort of manly job. The village elders say he's too young to go. He should be 14, but he's 12. But his dad's like, he's ready.
And the mother really, you know, Isla, she's very much like, no, he's too young. And she's very protective of him, obviously.
And so but then they run into an alpha, which is this new thing that they've introduced because there's been so many years of the infected that there's these alphas, these massive male infected who are stronger and faster and more ferocious than the regular ones. And that causes them to have to basically run back home. So it's kind of this stalled rite of passage because they're being beset by infected, and the boy's trying to hit his targets with the arrow, but he's too scared. So I think in that part you get the dad is kind of it's building up his physical coming of age with his, because he's trained him and all of this sort of stuff, but he doesn't quite have the emotional coming of age yet. This event kind of stalls that.
So for me, this first part, yeah, that it is interesting that you have this journey with the father, and it's very much about this taking on this masculine role, stepping into manhood, facing fears. Also, this part is very much, you know, the kind of thing that we recognize from the other 28.
Yeah.
Series of films, very visceral. You get these, these amazing sequences where at one point they end up kind of holding this house, and you know, there's just horror coming from all angles. They find this one infected that's been upside down, and it's been carved into this work that's named Jimmy, and the head's got a bag around the head, and there's all this blood. It's just really, really awful. And there's also the alpha is looming outside. You're also introduced to these like slow lows, these bloated creatures almost, infected that are eating, like seen eating earthworms and so on. So it's expanding out, you know, the different types of infected, but it's still very much in keeping with the, you know, there's danger around every corner. How are you going to survive? And it is that very physical, visceral feeling. And then you have that amazing run down the causeway as high tide is coming in, and they're being chased by the alpha. But yet also at the same time, there's the Northern Lights, because it's no longer London. It's no longer that urban set. It's this more rural setting in the north. After that, they come back and they're all being celebrated, and Spike's being celebrated. And it's this almost this loss of innocence that happens after they arrive back, where he starts to see his father for who he really is. So one of the things that Jamie does is he starts talking and telling the story, and he's not telling what actually happened. Mm. He's embellishing, and he's saying, oh, Spike, you know, the Spike who was scared and was missing or couldn't shoot, he's saying that he could and that he was very brave and heroic. And then also as he leaves, he sees his father with another woman.
Yeah.
And so, at home, his mother, Isla, is very, very ill. They don't know what's wrong with her. And so it's this whole thing of this coming of age, rite of passage with the father, and then he comes back and he's completely disappointed.
Yeah, and it kind of I think this is the real coming of age, is like when he sees his father's failings, and that is because when they're out on the mainland is when he's like, what's that fire over there? And he says, oh, there's this doctor there, and we saw him with all these bodies, and he's insane, so don't go near him. He's like, okay, sure, I won't go near him. But there's this twinkle of like curiosity about that, though. But then when he sees, when his father starts telling all these lies about what happened, and then he sees him basically cheat on his mother, that's when he realizes, well, he doesn't always tell the truth. So what is he not telling the truth about this doctor guy? And my mum's sick, so we need to do something about it. And so his idea is to basically sneak his mum out of the island and go see this doctor on the mainland against everybody's wishes. And that's his, I think this is the start of his emotional coming of age. And so this, it becomes, again, they on the mainland, another sort of almost like a road movie, where it's him and his mum going through, and there are these the security guys who end up, whose boat sinks, and they end up on the mainland, and they all get killed except for the Swedish guy who they run into him. They could just kind of have this run-ins with these different characters. They find a pregnant infected, and that's what I was saying before about Eric, the Swedish soldier. Mm. His first instinct is to kill the infected, but Isla's first instinct is to help her give birth. And so they fight. They get this baby who's not infected. They can't see any sign of infection on this baby. So obviously the infected are evolving into something new, into another civilization that's separate from the survivors and their families. And then they find the doctor, Dr. Kelson, played by Ralph Fiennes, who's amazing. Kind of this like benign Colonel Kurtz character. And what he's done, and what he had all these bodies, the dad, he's built this bone temple that basically he's rounded up every dead body he can find. He's polished the bones and he's built this monument, this memento mori, this remembrance of the dead, which completely rewrite. I think it doesn't completely rewrite, but I think it recontextualizes the whole idea of what we think of as a post-apocalyptic movie in a way. Like, because a lot of post-apocalyptic movies have this kind of romantic fantasy about it. Like, we all have this. I mean, let's face it. In the back of our mind, we all want in the apocalypse to be like Mad Max, right? Or be like some badass. Like, oh, you know, my life sucks now, but in the wasteland, I'll be like, I'll have a samurai sword and a V8 or a motorcycle, and I'll just be like lopping the heads of zombies everywhere, and I'll be amazing. But what this sort of memento mori says to me is like, it's that the apocalypse is this grim, sad, traumatizing experience, and it's this, and it's like, and we think of, and in all these movies, there's so many people are getting killed and so many zombies or whatever are getting killed. We don't stop to think about that these are people that have lived lives and have died. And it's kind of, it's the film kind of stopping to make us look at this and kind of not indulge in the fantasy so much. And then I think that's where Spike really comes into his own, because they find out the doctor, by examining Isla, realizes that she has cancer and that she doesn't have long to live. So she chooses death while Spike's sleeping. Kelson gives her a sedative or gives her morphine, overdoses her, and she dies. And then he just drags her body off and polishes her bones and then just hands Spike, because he's got this pile of skulls in the center of the bone temple, right? So he gives him the skull to like, and he goes and places her skull on the top of the pile. And it's this beautiful moment. And I just think there comes a time in every young boy's life when he's handed the polished skull of his mother.
Mm. Has nowhere to place it.
But then, and so that's, I think that's, and because Kelson is this character of like, if you look at like Joseph Campbell and all of that, he's like the elderly mentor who stands on the threshold. So the hero has to walk through the threshold, right? He has to, he has to go to the Death Star, to rescue Princess Leia, that sort of thing. And he needs Obi-Wan Kenobi's help. So Kelson stands on the threshold and basically prepares Spike for his next phase, which is like the third part of this movie.
So for me, I mean, I did not expect this film to be so emotional as it was. That whole scene with Isla, and as she basically chooses to die, and well, she knows that it's inevitable and she wants to go on her terms. Oh my goodness, I was shedding a tear, I have to say. And I think you're definitely right that Kelson is this kind of mentor guiding figure. And so for me, I just kept thinking about it is mythical. It almost felt like the young King Arthur or something like that, and that you have him. You know, you have all these masculine figures. He has his father, who takes him out, but then, you know, he realizes the failings. And then also alongside that, you have the Alpha.
Yeah.
These new infected, which is just absolute base,
yeah,
brutal masculinity. And it's interesting, you know, he's referred to as the Alpha, and you know, all the, you know, on the, like I said, in the online space, don't they always refer to like certain men as alphas? He's so brutal that he rips the head, not just the heads, yeah, but the spinal columns of, yeah, of people.
Seems to be his favorite thing to do.
He like leaves trophies on as well. And as you also put it, he's almost like the dragon or the Minotaur, yeah, or something like that. So you have, or almost like Caliban in The Tempest or something, that is total base, savage, primal self, almost part of the self. Yeah, it's interesting. We could even go that you've got the primal kind of id, and then you've got the father, the law of the father, and then you've got Kelson as well. Mm. And then you also at the end have Jimmy. Yeah. But we'll get that to the...
Well, yeah, but because with the part of the when he's kind of has the moment with Kelson, and he's like, you have to take this baby because I've got this baby, and it's like, you have to do something with this baby. And so I think the journey that he's got, that Spike's gone on, like he goes back to the island, but he leaves the baby, and he leaves a note for his father saying that he can't come back. So it's like Spike's reached this emotional and a physical maturity. He's got all these tools, but it means he can never return home. Like he becomes an outsider like Kelson. It's almost like he's gone through so much that he can't just go back to the farm. He has to continue on. Like he has to know what's going on out there.
He's kind of crossed over in some ways.
He's become this like liminal figure, like Kelson existing between these two worlds.
Mm.
So, and I think that's where the Doctor's influence comes in. And he just goes out on his own. And at this point, I did think, like, surely the film's coming to an end. And it almost felt like there was more. And then he gets attacked by these infected. And then, yeah, we get Jimmy showing up. So Jimmy is obviously the little boy from the cold open who has now become an adult and has a bunch of cronies with him. And they all dress like Jimmy Savile.
I know. I did not get that. I'm just like, why have they got these weird wigs? And then it was only when I was reading later and I was like, oh, that's supposed to be Jimmy Savile. I'm like, oh my God. Okay. That's because I think, I don't know when it was actually found out about Jimmy Savile, whether that was after 2002 when people realized that he was actually this hideous pedophile and had just done these just awful, atrocious things. I don't know when they actually found that out, whether if this event happened where the infection took over and Britain was quarantined, was that after 2002? And if so, do they still really revere for Jimmy Savile? And again, it might be another instance of lionizing aspects of Britain's past that maybe doesn't deserve it. But but it is interesting to think about, because as I was watching the film, I kept thinking about Alex Garland's Men, because that so much is about, I mean, that going back to kind of British folklore, and you had the Green Man and Sheila na Gig, which are these two archetypes of masculinity and femininity. So I felt like there was this aspect definitely going on in 28 years later.
Yeah.
Also the fact that you had, you know, these strange births that you also get in Men. Also the fact that the infected can breed. So there's some sexuality into them maybe somehow. And again, that makes me think of Ex Machina, which we're going to talk about in our next episode.
Yes.
And there's debates there about giving a robot sexuality. So, I don't know. Something happened to impregnate that infected.
Yeah.
So there's all these Garland-esque, can I use that word?
Yeah.
Aspects to the film that I think are really, really interesting. But yeah, we end with, I think it's St. Jimmy he's supposed to be known as. So yeah,
O'Connell.
Yeah, yes, he's in two of the best horror films of the year, this and Sinners. And I did not realize until we were walking home at the end after seeing the film where I was like, oh, wait, yeah, so he's the little kid from the beginning. Yeah. So he's obviously the kid from the beginning. Obviously, him and his gang go around doing some terrible things because that guy that they find hanging upside down when Spike is with his dad, I think he even says, oh, he wasn't infected.
But yeah, left him for the infected.
So they've left him for the infected. They've carved Jimmy and hung him upside down. Mm. So, and now Spike is with them.
Yeah, and you notice that they all wear all their different coloured suits, like the Teletubbies that they're watching at the beginning of the film. And also people saying they're like Power Rangers, and Spike had a Power Ranger toy which he left when he went on the hunt originally, as if like putting away childish things. And I think Jimmy is obviously older than Spike, and he knew the world before everything went to shit. And so he's grown up with this nostalgia and, you know, in this world of like trying to fight back, and the way they do all these backflips and kung fu moves on all these infected is like, that's the fantasy of the post-apocalyptic movie, right? It's like, that's the way we all wish that we'd be like in, you know, fighting zombies in the wasteland is that. So I'm guessing like Spike's had these mentors of his father and his mother and Kelson, and now he's going to have this mentor of Jimmy, and he's going to be seeing like the dark reflection of himself, really. And I think that he's going to get taken back to wherever he lives. And I'm sure he's probably like the ruler of some enclave, because, you know, you see at the start his dad is a priest, so he would know like how to work a crowd after having seen his dad, right? And his dad was like, oh, it's the rapture, hooray, hallelujah, and he's getting torn apart and being like, yay, like God has come to judge us. So he obviously had a very strict, warped religious upbringing. So that's going to figure heavily into it, I think. And, of course, his dad's going to come looking for him, because the next film is apparently directed by Nia DaCosta and is coming out in January, and that if that does well enough, there'll be a third film, which apparently Cillian Murphy's going to show up in. So there's a lot of stuff. And that's the thing, when Jimmy shows up at the end, it's like, oh, there's a whole other bit to this movie. Isn't this going to end? And then it ended and I'm like, no, I want to see more of Jimmy. This is like so nuts. It's such a wild like
turn.
And then the movie ends and it's like, oh, this is great.
Yeah, yeah. Although I did have this whole thing of like, oh, God, you know, we do live in this time where a movie can't just end. It's like, oh, now I've got to wait months for the next one. It's like,
hook.
I just want to, yeah. So, but I think it definitely does seem like it is, you know, we keep saying it, the coming of age. Mm. He's separated from his parents. He's had this mentor in Kelson, and now he's met Jimmy.
Yeah.
And so obviously, you know, the next one, I think, must be the second one in a trilogy is always the darkest. Yeah, yeah, so if he's going to be with Jimmy and his gang, I think it's going to get pretty dark.
Yeah.
Because they're obviously doing some really dark shit. And then, I hope to God that we get the third one then, because, yeah, it's definitely setting itself up for something.
Yeah, and I think it's, like I said, it's this world is a world, you know, I'm always happy to return to this world. As grim as it is, I think it's like they set up a really interesting idea, and it's interesting to see such a big time jump. So we haven't really seen what happened between weeks and years. There was no 28 months later, and you know, part of me wonders, oh, I wonder what that would have been like. But it's kind of good not to have that. It's good to have is to kind of just be dropped into like this alien world, really, because it kind of no longer the world. I mean, we're going to go to Jimmy's world, which will probably have a lot of like ephemera stuff that we recognize. I mean, the only real thing I remember from the film is when they go to the petrol station and it's a Shell station with the S missing, so it says Hell. And the train car, and like there's very little like signifiers of the modern world. There's some shots of houses that are all destroyed and stuff, but it's so run down that it's almost unrecognizable.
Mm. But yeah, we're going to be there opening weekend.
Absolutely.
For the next one. I mean, so that's it. So that's our first Sci-Fries Bites.
Sci-Fries Bites.
Yes. All right. So, watch out for, or listen out for our next episode. We will go back to our season on AI and Technofear, where we will be looking at Alex Garland's directorial debut, Ex Machina, as well as 1977's Demon Seed, directed by Donald Cammell, starring Julie Christie. So please come back and listen for that. All right.
Until then. Bye-bye.